property.
Okay. Welcome and Chodesh Tov, everybody. It's still Chodesh Tov. Let's dedicate, please, tonight's learning to our hostages, our soldiers and reservists, their families. And may our learning be of merit and help to anyone so that this nightmare will end. But also, you're going to hear tonight from two Elisheva's, me and Elisheva. But there is another Elisheva, this is Tali's daughter-in-law, who is in need of a refuah shlema. And her Hebrew name is Elisheva Mendel Bat Masha Tzvia. I'm going to speak first, and then we're going to hear from Elisheva Rabinowitz, and who will guide us in walking to Sinai, a Shavuot meditation. Known professionally as Lisa Rabinowitz, this Elisheva is an experienced couples therapist specializing in communication, ADHD, and early attachment effects on relationships. Her book, Why Won't You Stop Interrupting Me? Simple Solutions for ADHD Couples, was just published and it's available on Amazon.
Okay.
I've got some notes. I apologize, I'm not a seasoned presenter or teacher or anything like that, so I'm gonna speak from my cheat sheets. And I'll just start, first of all, many of you know I'm a convert. I converted a long time ago in my mid-30s. And Shavuot is kind of a special holiday for me. It's not my favorite, but it is a special one because it was the first holiday I celebrated as a Jew. And I happened to get to be fortunate enough to be in Yerushalayim, and I got to go down to the Kotel in the middle of the night with all the people. It was so special. So I do really appreciate this holiday. And it translates, or it's the Feast of Weeks, and it occurs exactly 7 weeks after the start of Passover. And on Shavuot, we read Megillat Rut. I'm sure this is easy stuff, you guys know it, but I'm going to say it anyway. And that's the story of the most famous convert in Tanakh, I would say. There are a few others, but this one is the most famous. And just to recap the book, Rut is one of the five Megillot, the scrolls, and it's part of the section of Tanakh called from Kitubim. And it begins with the Elimelech, a very influential man. It was a rich man, and his wife Naomi and their two sons, and they leave Beit Lechem, which ironically is the house of bread, during a famine. And they travel to, they basically abandon their home city and their people in a time of need. They leave, they have money, they go, they leave everybody. And they travel to Moab. Now, I'll pass this around. It's kind of small, but Beit Lechem, or Bethlehem, is right here. It's part of Judah, and here's Moab. So they're on the other side. They're in, what's today Jordan. So just for if anybody needs to see it and kind of get a sense of the direction, how much distance may have been traveled or not. When they get to Moab, Elimelech dies. Now, the way the text is written, it's almost like they go to Moab and he dies. Some surmise it's because it was a punishment, because he left. He abandoned his people. Who knows? I'm not going to judge that, but that's how people interpret that, the way the text is so succinct like that. So then Naomi is left with her two sons, and they marry local women, Moabite women, and they live there for 10 years, and then the sons die. And there are people who say that because they didn't go back, they died too. They had the opportunity, the famine was over, they died. They died childless. Both couples were childless. And Naomi urges her daughters-in-law, both of them, to go back to their mothers and not follow her back, because she has heard the famine's over, she's going back. And it would be a really true tragedy if the story ended here. She's lost her son, sons. She's lost her husband. She's saying, go back to your homes. Just leave me alone. I'm nobody. But that isn't the case. And Ruth, who is also a widow herself, insists on staying with her her mother-in-law, who's a widow. And she declares famously, where you go, I will go. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Together, they go back to Beit Lechem, and Naomi tells them, when she gets there, the local women say, can this be Naomi? You know, the trophy wife Naomi, the pretty one, the wealthy one, can this be, this poor destitute woman be Naomi? And Naomi says, don't call me Naomi, which is from like Noam or pleasant. She said, call me Mara. My life has been embittered. I'm bitter. And eventually, through this course of events, Ruth's kindness and loyalty to lead her to this field of this relative, Boaz, and she ultimately marries him, and they have a child, who later becomes, their child becomes the grandfather of King David, making Ruth the great-grandmother of King David. Okay. What do we know or believe we know about Ruth? First of all, she's widowed. She's in the text. She's from the text. So she's had some heartbreak. She doesn't have children, which is a heartbreak. At least none are mentioned in the text. We assume that she's had no children. You know, there's no reference to miscarriages or anything like that. There is in Midrashic interpretations and some historical context that we believe that she was actually a princess. She was a Moabite princess. And this is, and it's in the Talmud, different places, and she may have been the granddaughter of King Eglon of Moab, and he can trace his lineage back to Balak, who was the Moabite king in the time of Moshe. So she has some Yehus with her, but it doesn't help her when she goes back to Beit Lechem. She's just as poor as her mother-in-law. She is not known for her beauty. There are women in Tanakh who are known for their beauty, like Bathsheba. She was known to be very beautiful. There's Abigail, who was also a wife of David, King David, and she was known to be, beautiful in looks and of good sense. So not only was she smart, she was pretty too. You know, she had it all. But Ruth is described as being young and worthy. She's hardworking. She doesn't seek rest in the hut. Her good deeds precede her. Like Boaz already knows what a good person she is because he says, I've already heard of your good deeds. Naomi. She is actually a good listener and follows advice. Like she listens to Naomi's advice, she listens to Boaz's advice, you know, and he says, stick with my handmaids, do what they do, come here, you know, she accepts advice well. And she's loyal. She's also modest because there's the scene in the threshing floor at night where she's told to go at night, and it would probably be a little unseemly for a woman to be there in the middle of the night, and yet she makes sure that she gets up early in the morning so that no one sees this and makes this accusation of her being immodest. So I think that kind of speaks to the character of her. Who wrote the Book of Ruth? The story takes place in the time of Judges. So it's after the conquest of Canaan, and there's no particular author that's named, but it does mention David's lineage at the end, so therefore it was written after David became king. And tradition says it was written by Shmuel, and Shmuel was the last of the judges. He was also a prophet. And he was the one who anointed King Shaul and then anointed David. And I was listening to this podcast that basically said that Shmuel wrote this book because he needed to kind of give validity to David's kingship. Because who was David descended from? He was descended from this Moabite woman. And you're not supposed to allow Moabites to marry in. So he's telling this whole story to basically say that it's okay. And how is it okay? If we go back to Devarim, the Jews were forbidden from allowing Moabites to marry in because they did not meet you with bread and water on the road when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam to prophesy against you. But the prohibition was actually against the men of Moab. It wasn't against the women, because the men were the ones who would have come out to meet them in the field, you know, to approach them as a moving force. And it was the men who were the ones who were unkind. The women wouldn't have done that. The women were not allowed to go out and meet an oncoming force. So in some ways, it's like Ruth is a tikkun for her ancestors. She's the kind one. Like, if we don't know anything about Ruth, we know that she's kind. And so she is a tikkun for this cruelty that was shown, or lack of kindness that was shown by her ancestors. Now, she's the most famous convert. And where do you guys think she converted? What is her conversion?
To the
rabbinate.
Right?
Not in your time.
Zohar wasn't around then.
There was no such thing then, right? I mean, as conversion, you just followed.
She accepted her mother-in-law.
The
religion.
I don't know.
Sit down.
Maybe because she asked Naomi several times. Naomi sent her away. It was like the
three times.
You want to be with me. I think it happens today the same way.
You're supposed to. Rabbis are supposed to shoo you away.
Yeah.
You know. I know that when I first approached a rabbi, I was shooed away. Mm-hmm. I wasn't shooed like this, but I was discouraged. He said it was during college, and he said, "Wait till you get out of college. Wait till you get settled." You know. And so, it took me another 10 years to get back to that point. So, but I don't think, a lot of people will say it's when she makes that statement, your God will be my God, you know, whatever. Some people say that, but I think that there was probably some kind of tacit conversion that happened before then, because the text gives us a clue. When Naomi sends her daughters-in-law back, she says, go back to your mother's house. Now, we know from other times in Tanakh, it talks about the father's house. Like if a woman is widowed or divorced, she goes back to her father's house, right? And we have a sense that Ruth's father was alive. So it could be that because she uses the word, like Naomi actually uses the word, your mother's house, one possible reason for this, like, kind of twist in the language is because, according to Midrash, a convert doesn't legally have a father anymore. Like you, as a convert, you don't like keep on using, you don't use your parents' names, Furufua or anything like that, because you become a bat or a ben of Abraham and Sarah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So your parents are kind of pushed like this, you know. And that's why, like, this whole evening, these Rosh Chodesh gatherings are done in memory of my mother, but I didn't feel it was appropriate to say Kaddish for her, you know, because...
But some people do.
Some people do, but there's no obligation to. I'm not under any obligation to my parents, which I think is wrong. I mean, there should be some acknowledgement. I mean, I don't think converts who accept Judaism come out of a vacuum. Most of them are raised in an environment that allows their heart to receive Judaism. Do you know what I mean? I think your parents should get some credit for that. I don't know. Anyway, but that's one clue that we have, that there may have been some kind of conversion prior to. And the other one is, Naomi says to Ruth, she says, "See, your sister-in-law has returned to her people and her gods." Gods, lowercase, plural. Go follow your sister-in-law. So that kind of indicates that up to that point, she had not had those gods. So there was a change. There was a change from having those gods to not having those gods. So there was a change in their status, at least spiritually, at some point. So I think that there was some kind of conversion. And it could be that Elimelech and the sons converted, or there was no formal process, but all you had to do was accept this type of lifestyle, whatever, and that was enough. But it was enough that Naomi, and maybe this was culturally for all of the Middle East, I don't know, I'm not this kind of a historian or anything, but that, you know, Naomi says to her, she says to both of them, "I don't have any more sons to give you. Like, I don't have a Levirate marriage. I can't help you honor that, or I can't help that process." But she does say, "Even if I were to have children today, would you wait?" So I think that there was already, that's another clue that these two women were already into the covenant of Judaism somehow. Okay, now, this is just kind of background and thoughts. Like I said, the Shavuot was my first holiday as a Jew, but it really took on some other meaning as a story of love, Naomi for Ruth and Naomi, and also I think Boaz had great love and respect for her, and I think Ruth had for him also. And I got this inclination of it when Stevie and I, my husband, used to keep bees. And we would do our honey extraction at night, because you don't want to be whirling honey through a centrifuge and you'd be swarmed by bees if you did it during the daytime. So a lot of extraction, especially if it's done outside, is done at night. So it's done around this time of year because the honey flow is over and things like that. And we guys know this is a beautiful time of year in Israel, yeah? It is like incredible. And we know it's the same time of year because Ruth and Naomi arrived during the barley harvest. It was this time of year. And if you go out at night, the air is cool, there's crickets chirping. I think it was a very lovely, love-inducing environment that they were in already, working in the fields, being on the threshing floor at night. You know, you're working hard, and it's like the day's over. I think there was some romance there, you know, even if it wasn't like acted upon, it was there. So there was love in the air, you know. But it's also a real story of just kindness, you know. Ruth is so kind to Naomi, and Boaz is so kind to Ruth. And the Torah, you know, we're commanded to be very kind to the stranger, because you were strangers in a strange land. We are commanded 36 times in the Torah. Some people even say 46 times. It's almost more than any other thing. It's a recurring theme in the Torah. And I just want to read you something that I found, which I was just so surprised by when I read this. This is written by Rabbi Sarah Horwitz. It's the first Orthodox institution to ordain women as clergy, okay? And she said, "The Gemara, Sanhedrin 99b, recounts the story of a biblical character, Timnah." I've never heard of her, but there's some very nice canyons named after her. Anyway, and she wanted to convert, and so she came before Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, but they did not accept her. Now, I don't know if this is the three times refused, if this is where it comes from or not. So distressed, she went to become a concubine to Eliphaz, the son of Esau. And from her came Amalek, who afflicted Israel. Why so? Because they should have not pushed her away. Now this is like a very harsh criticism of the Avot, but it's like, wow, this is, I'd never heard this before. You know, it's probably not a very popular Gemara. Anyway, I found that was very interesting, and just a reminder that, you know, like, well, this whole story of Ruth, you know, we don't know what will come out of the convert. We don't know what goodness will be brought to the people. Through Ruth, we got King David, who was incidentally born and died on Shavuot. So again, there's another kesher to why we say this now. But getting back to the whole story of Shavuot, it is in a sense the conversion moment of the Jewish people. What are the three things you have to do as a convert? If you're a man, you have to be circumcised. Everybody goes to mikveh, and everybody has to make a verbal acceptance of the Torah. So the men coming out of Egypt had been circumcised. That's not a problem. But everybody had to immerse. And before the revelation at Sinai, the Jews were commanded to go immerse themselves in preparation for coming face to face with God. And in the desert, they used the well of Miriam as the mikvah. And then their verbal acceptance of Torah is Na'aseh v'nishma. We will do and we will hear. And I think that's a very interesting thing. We will do it first and then we will hear it. You'd think it'd be the opposite, right? We'll hear it first and then we'll do it. But I think it's meant to be not so much as we will hear it, we will listen. It's more that we will listen to it. We will understand it. We will feel it inside of us. And that's the we will do and we will understand. We will, so that by practicing what the Torah gives us, then we begin to understand it. And I think this, you know, what were they doing? What were they listening to? They were listening to the actual Aseret HaDibrot. They were listening to the Ten Commandments. That's what Moshe came down with. And they start with, what did they start with? They start with, I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods beside me. And what did Ruth say?
Your God.
Your God is my God. So I think that it was a conversion of the people. That's why we study a story about a woman who was a convert without going into all the details and minutiae of her conversion. Because what was important in the story is that her connection to the people was unbreakable. You know, she went back, she was a princess, and she went back with Naomi with no promise of anything, nothing. Like, Naomi's like, I can't give you sons, you know, there's nothing, I can give you nothing. And she still went, and her dedication was so incredible. And I think that, you know, we are all, you know, the tradition tells us that every soul, past, present, and future, including convert souls, were at Sinai for the receiving of the Torah. So, with that, I would like to have Elisheva come up and get us ready, mentally, spiritually, to be in this space of standing at Sinai.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's also a lesson about brothers and mothers.
Yes, true. That's true. They could be better. Should I turn down the light? Okay.
Can I help you with anything?
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. So, I'm going to be guiding you through a mindfulness. Everybody hear me okay?
Yeah.
I'm going to be guiding you through a mindfulness practice. It's going to include four different parts. The first part is us connecting to our breath. The second part will be us gently scanning our body for any tension. Third, we're going to cultivate compassion and loving kindness. And fourth, we're going to journey to Sinai. So I'm going to ask you to get comfortable in your chair. Can you hear me okay?
Get up.
Mm-hmm. Everybody hear me okay? Just be comfortable. Feel free to sit on the couch. If you're holding something, you might want to just put it down. I don't want you to drop things. All right. Find a comfortable position. I'm going to ask you to allow your arms to just sort of rest at your side. If you're comfortable, you may close your eyes or just soften your gaze. We'll wake you up at the end. Let's begin with our breath. I'm going to ask you to take a slow, deep breath through your nose. Hold that just for a gentle, just for a moment. And exhale slowly through your mouth. Let's do that again. Just take a slow, deep breath through your nose. Hold. And exhale slowly through your mouth. Let go of any tension. Let go of the day. One more time, breathing in deeply. Feeling your belly. Exhale, feeling your big body beginning to settle. Let's begin by bringing your attention to the top of your head. Notice any sensations, warmth, tingling, stillness. And with each breath, soften. Starting with your forehead. Notice any tension or tightness around your eyes, your jaw. If your mind drifts, just bring it back to my voice. Bringing awareness to your neck, your shoulders. Letting them drop just a little heavier with each exhale. Letting go of anything that you're holding. Your neck, your shoulders, moving down, bringing the attention to your arms. Bringing warmth down to your hands. Feeling like pulsing gently through your arms and into your hands. Now bringing your awareness to your chest, your heart. Feel it rise and fall with each breath. Let your heart be soft. Let your heart be open. Moving into your belly, releasing any gripping, any holding, any tightness. Moving slowly down into your hips and sinking deeper into comfort, into support. Bring your attention to your legs, down to your ankles, all the way to your feet and toes. Grounding, releasing. With no judgment, just notice from your head to your chest, your whole body, present, safe. And bring any more breath to any place that is tight. Now silently or softly repeat words to yourself. May I be safe. May I be healthy. May I be love. May I be at peace. Breathe into those words. Let them land into your body. Now think of someone you care about. Someone you can bring warmth. Somebody who brings warmth to your heart. Silently or softly repeat. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you be loved. And may you be at peace. Let's extend that further to the Chayalim, to the hostages, to Klal Yisrael, to anyone else. Let the wave, let the wind carry your loving kindness to them. May we all be safe. May we all be healthy. May we all be loved. And may we all find peace. Notice your breath. Your mind is drifting, just bring it back. As we journey from the quiet Ashkelon beaches, where the sky is a soft blue, the sun is warm on your skin, where you feel safe, supported, and held. Visualize the ocean stretching out in front of you, vast and calm. Waves rolling in, rolling out. With each wave that comes into shore, breathe in calm. As you visualize the waves returning to sea, breathe out any tension. Breathe in peace. Breathe out stress. And as you sit or walk along the shore in your mind, allow your heart to be opened with love and kindness. Take a moment to feel the ground beneath you, solid, steady, supporting you. And let's take a journey to the desert. Imagine yourself walking in the desert. The same desert as our ancestors, crossing so many thousands of years ago. The air is warm, dry, and filled with an ancient silence. The sun hovers gently overhead, not harsh, but golden and watchful. The sand shifts softly beneath your feet, a reminder that every step is both movement and transformation. With each step forward, you feel time stretch and blur. You are no longer in the present moment. You are walking across generations. The rhythm of your breath echoes the footsteps of your ancestors. Feel the wind brush across your face, hearing whispers of prayers, promises made long ago. You are not walking alone. Around you, souls walking quietly and steadily. Some you recognize, your grandparents, your teachers, your mentors. Some are unknown to you, but familiar to your neshama, to your soul. They are walking with you, not ahead of you, not behind you, just beside you. Because this journey is not solitary, it is shared. It has always been shared. These are the people who carry stories, struggles, and faith across miles and centuries. People who face uncertainty, but walk forward anyway. People whose hopes are folded into yours, whose love still lights your path. As you walk, you begin to notice that you're carrying things, burdens, beliefs, fears, perhaps the voice that says, you're not enough. Maybe the voice of perfectionism, shame, comparison. Now it's the time to release them. With your breath, imagine them drifting away with the waves and let go of the fear. Let go of the doubt. Let go of the old voices that say you are not enough. Let each step become a quiet act of surrender. With each exhale, feel your load growing lighter. Feel yourself walking not just toward something, but returning to something. And now in the distant Har Sinai rises before you, majestic, quiet, waiting. It is not a mountain of intimidation, but of invitation. The mountain is burning in fire till the heart of heaven. And just as the fire burned to the heart of heaven, feel the enthusiasm, the spiritual passion. It calls to the deepest, deepest part of you, the part that longs to listen, to remember, to receive. As you approach the base, you pause. And you place your hands gently over your heart. Feel the rhythm of life, truth, purpose. And ask yourself, what am I ready to receive? What wisdom do I need to hear now, in this season of my life? And what part of myself have I forgotten that I need to reclaim? Let the questions rise, and let the answers come not in words, but in stillness. In knowing, in being. Breathe in that truth. And as you breathe out, let that settle into you. Feeling yourself standing at the base of Sinai, not in memory, not in imagination, but in a sacred presence. You are not just remembering that moment. You are in that moment. You are part of it. Your soul was there then, and it is now. You belong here. You are ready. You are whole. And Sinai is waiting again for you. Feel the breeze against your face. Hear the rhythm of the waves. Hear the song. Allow the song that emanates from your heart to lift you up to the very heart of heaven. First reveal to you the giving of the Torah. May your prayers be fueled by the heavenly fire of Torah. And may your learning, singing, and tefillot illuminate the prayers of your heart. Know that this calm, this love, lives within you, always available, always true. And you take another deep breath in, and exhale fully. When you're ready, begin to gently return to this space, to your chairs. Wiggle your fingers and your toes, and let's carry the stillness of Sinai with us. May peace stay with you, and may, when you're ready, come back to the room. Thank you all. I don't think anybody fell asleep. Thanks, Molly. I don't know if you have any questions, or I try to give a lot of different reasons to different
things. Do you do this only in groups?
No, I do it every day with couples and clients. There's a lot of mindfulness.
And you hope to achieve what besides tremendous relaxation?
A lot of times it's connection with ourselves, connection with others, to bring more loving kindness, more positive to our space, to the universe, and connecting with our, you know, yeah. Think about it.
Can you tell us something about your conversion?
I didn't actually get converted. I was not converted. Yeah, it's not, for me, it's not about being a convert.
We just spoke out the Hebrew name. But you are a twin, right?
I am a twin. Different than a convert.
Sorry about that.
It's taken in the beginning. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was the best. Yeah. And if you're not used to it, it's a little bit different. All right. Thank you.
Too relaxed to stand up.
Well, you can welcome the sit in the space. I think that what is so nice about this this idea of being at Sinai, reminding ourselves that we are there, we are whole. I love that you said that. You're whole. I think as women we can go through our lives and not feel whole, at least not every day, and maybe not even 5 minutes of the day, because we feel pulled in many directions. So I loved that you said that. And
I felt personally that it quietened the self-critic within myself, and I just felt warm from the sun being hugged all over. And I think self-love is the beginning. You have to love yourself before you can love somebody else and those around you. Thank you.
Yeah, I specifically put in words that I hear a lot. So.
Thank you.
Does anybody else have any thoughts to share? Heading toward this holiday? Good.
I just sit there. I just had pain in my hip. And then when I came here, I sat here. It's so uncomfortable. And while I was going, I was like fading away. Uh-huh. I faded completely away. I felt like I was falling asleep, going somewhere else. I'm like so relaxed. I could go to sleep.
It's amazing how just slowing down, you don't realize. You know, we, like you said, we live such rushed lives. To slow down and just to really notice our body and what's happening and slow down up here, too.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Right, so my specialty happens to be working with ADHD couples.
Yeah. Where one is ADHD or both?
Sometimes both, sometimes one. Just depends. Sometimes we just found out, and sometimes we've known that for 50 years. So it's just a lot of different things that come up for them, communication challenges, and different conflict around, sometimes around ADHD, and sometimes just other things. Thank you so much for letting me share.
Thank you.
We're also relaxed.
It seems like everybody's so relaxed. It's not because they were
about to break the spell.
It needs to move.
We're not leaving.
We should send around the tea lady. Somebody just told me that in Israel, you mentioned it, was it? The tea lady.
It's the tea lady from the Karen Kayamis. And Karen, you saw it. Yeah, Karen, you saw it, yeah. But it was the old story. 10 o'clock, if you didn't come, if you didn't take her glass of hot water and let her put the terrible tea bag in the tea into the water, you were dead.
Well, we don't want that.
Just for plain water, so you could put some coffee, some of the terrible coffee in those years in it. She never spoke to you again. She didn't look at you.
I just want to tell you, I have in the newspaper where it said that they cut her position. So that it was ending. I kept it.
Oh, the tea lady, they ended
the
her job?
Lady, the Jewish agency lost her job.
Oh. It was the joke about a murderer going around the Karen Yesod, the Jewish agency, and people were dropping at their desks and nobody noticed because really unnecessary. So we got to the tea lady. Or she got to the tea lady. When the tea lady was murdered, then all of a sudden they said, oh, there's a murderer. The stereotypes did exist.
Well, we should send the tea lady around when it gets up. Love.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Good. I didn't know if people had questions. I didn't know how much to do about my personal community version stuff. If anybody has questions, privately or publicly, you can ask me. And I'll do my best. So.
I'm always interested.
Yeah? Do you have any converts in your family?
No, but I'm just interested in your story because I don't know.
I grew up in a religious Christian home. That's why I said I don't think converts come out of nowhere. I think there usually is some kesher. Although they can be any religion. And mine happened to be more fundamentalist, evangelical type, Southern Baptist type. And I just didn't, philosophically, I didn't agree with Christianity anymore. I didn't accept this idea that you could be a good person, and if you hadn't accepted Jesus, you were going to hell. That didn't match with any kind of real system of justice out there, you know. So I went looking, but because I grew up on Bible stories, you know, I actually have here, somewhere here, a book of Bible stories that my grandmother gave me, and I have, like, you know, these old books. I kept them, you know. You know, this is like, I don't know how old this is. What is this?
Their Old Testament, their New Testament?
This one, they're both a mix, but, you know, the this one ends with Esther saves her people. So I guess this is all Tanakh stuff. Well, let's just see what it says. Let's see if it says the Ten Commandments, 63. Let's see what that picture looks like.
It's not going to be politically correct, I can tell you that.
Actually, it's not so bad, but it's like, here, the Ten Commandments. It's not what we picture, yeah? It's like a forestry mountain. Wow. Like, I always picture Har Sinai to be like, you know.
That's not Har Sinai.
Yeah.
It wasn't a desert.
Okay, they took some artistic license.
Artistic license.
You know, I grew up in that kind of environment, and so when I was in college, I had a lot of Jewish friends in my high school. I happened to go to the public school
that was in the neighborhood where a lot of Jewish kids lived. So a lot of my friends in high school and junior high were Jewish.
What neighborhood did you go to?
This was in Texas, in San Antonio. Mm-hmm. And so when I was in college, I had to take, like, I did a journalism degree, I did a liberal arts education, I had to take, like, philosophy. So I took Introduction to Judaism, that was a philosophy course. And I was very interested, so I approached the teacher, who was probably the Hillel rabbi, and he's the one who pushed me away the first time. And so then, like, 10 years later, I was in the right space in my life to pursue it again. So I did. And I met Stevie when I was in the process of conversion. So, you know, some people say they, you know, you're not supposed to convert for marriage. I don't care. What people all have their reasons. We all have our motivations in life. As long as you're genuine, whatever got you there, as long as you're genuine after that, what does it matter? I don't know. But I don't make the rules.
You're there about 10 years earlier.
Well, that's the whole point with, you know, Naseh v'nishma. Like, it is a process. You hear it, you do it, you learn it, you feel it, you understand it. So all of it is a process. So, sure.
I remember from years ago when I was immersed in learning that Naseh v'nishma, there's a whole concept that you don't have to understand, you jump into it. And it slowly becomes revealed. So, and that's a lot about, we have a lot of Judaism like that. You know, we're not always sure why the halachot are the way they are, but when you said that, it triggered memories from my past life, and it's so true. We do things, and then they become revealed why we're doing them. Like, sometimes it just doesn't make sense. And all of a sudden, one day, a light bulb goes on.
Yeah.
And that's basically it. So it was we don't have to understand. We do things that we don't in Judaism all the time.
Right, right.
It is what it is.
Right. And a lot of it is, I think, just practice for another generation. There might be things that we do, I'm sure there are things that we do now, that are really going to be relevant, you know, 100 generations from now. They're really not relevant for us, but we still do that. You know, we still keep it.
They were relevant in the past, and they're not relevant now. But we're hoping that one day they might be again.
They might be again. Yeah. Like the whole idea of Shemitah is one of those. Like, technically, we don't really need to keep it yet because we don't have the majority of the world's Jews living here. But at some point, so we should practice.
We're practicing it.
We're practicing it. You know.
That's what the rabbi said.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
And also, it's tradition. You want to keep the tradition door to door.
Yeah.
That's a big part of it too. And if we stop doing things, then that door gets very watered down. And we forget.
For sure.
So just do it, even though we don't understand it, so that one day somebody will.
So I was thinking, that just reminded me of something you said, that my husband said about converts and keeping traditions, is there's a prohibition somewhere that you can't have the Korban Pesach, and you cannot eat it, cannot do it with only converts, because they might be too zealous about it. You need someone who's like, remembers the tradition, isn't making it up, you know, just like, isn't like, I'm going to be better and I'll be more serious, and, you know. So it's like the, you know, the grandmother who breaks the chicken wings. Breaks the chicken as she puts it in the pot. Why do we do this? Because my grandmother did. Why? Because I had a small pot. You know, it's like one of those. You know. It wouldn't fit in one piece.
But the tradition was continued.
Yeah. So Stevie's grandmother, for instance, it was her tradition on Rosh Chodesh not to do laundry and not to write. Not to write. Did your? Yeah.
Not to sew.
That wouldn't bother me.
That wouldn't bother you. But did your mother's grandmothers keep anything like that?
My niece did.
Yeah.
She never did laundry.
My Eastern European grandmother. My Hasidic line, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, my grandfather was a Hasidic rabbi on one side, and the other side was a Breuer's.
Yeah.
Doctor. So they were all religious, but they were very different worlds. And the Eastern European did, the Hasidic side did a lot of not weird things, but they were different.
Yeah.
I remember different customs in their house. I wonder why.
Yeah.
And then we understood it when we were older.
Yeah.
But they always had more of a superstitious kind of, like, Pesach Shem. My Bubby used to break a piece of matzah and put it on her ledge at the end of Seder.
On the ledge? Outside?
Ledge, like on a wall ledge, like a doorway. Wherever she could put it.
I've seen that.
I've seen that too.
And it was like really, but then later, when I, and it shouldn't tell us why, we went every Pesach, and, but then later I think I figured it out.
Why?
I don't want to be wrong, but I think it was about Pesach Sheni.
Oh.
So they'd have matzah. I think that's what it was for. It had to be.
Interesting.
Like, it had to. Otherwise I'd be wrong.
Interesting.
They have all these little. Interesting.
Yeah. I always thought it'd make a great movie, like a short clip, short film, to do challah cutting techniques. Right? There's so many do this first. Like, I think that would be just
an OCD.
But it would make a. Do you throw it? Do you not throw it? Are you forbidden to throw it? We have a.
Pass it to somebody or not?
Right. So I don't know if you've noticed in Ashkelon, people don't throw away bread here, right?
Yes.
All our neighbors are leaving their bread on the garbage cans.
That's
a party thing, right?
They cannot throw bread out, so you leave it out. Because Think of Yerushalayim 150 years ago, 100 years ago.
Cats.
No, I don't know if there were cats, but there were very hungry people. There were a lot of very hungry people.
I think cats.
And would eat day-old bread, 2-day-old bread. In Feinschmeckers, we don't do that. And it's Minhag Yerushalayim. It's just gone to other places in Israel.
Isn't it a Minhag also in Yerushalayim, or it used to be, that you did not lock your front door at the mealtime? You left your front door open so that if anybody wanted to come in, they could come in? Because, you know, the family up here on Zonenville, it's just as you round the corner in the White House with the big round, they have a little plaque that basically says kind of that. But it's like, it's all the time. And I think it's maybe the midday meal, like lunch, and not just on Shabbat, but it's just...
I grew up like that, even though I was in the Lower East Side. My mother left the door open till, I guess at some point, there was more crime. Then she started locking the door, but she had a hard time doing that.
Wow.
Where did you grow up? Not Harlem?
No, Lower East Side in Manhattan. But my mother and father had also grown up at Lower East Side. My father came from Germany, but my mother was born there.
We got yelled at if we left the door.
They probably knew all the neighbors between the three of you.
Thank you. We had a very open kitchen. We lived on the first floor. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein lived across the street from me, but I was a little kid. I just saw all these guys in strimals walking around. I didn't know one from another. And I didn't realize it till I was older that that's who it was. My family was not religious because my mother grew up very religious, but she couldn't pick and choose, like either you're religious or you're not. She couldn't see, I'll just light candles, but then I'll dry. You know, she's like, it didn't make any sense to her. And my father grew up, he was Jewish, but he bar mitzvah, but didn't do any of that. In fact, I guess my mother had such an upbringing, my father introduced her to peanut butter. It was just she ate all this whatever, you know, chicken or chicken. She didn't have that.
My father's Dutch, and it was never on our table.
She was Austrian.
The neighbors.
Yeah.
For chicken every
time. But it's very funny.
Why peanut butter? Because it wasn't part of the menu.
My father thought it was disgusting.
You know that?
My father liked it, but my mother didn't make it. She's a little one.
I have a granddaughter and a grandson who are converts. but they were fostered to adopt. So first they were living with my daughter and son-in-law, and then they adopted them in New Jersey. And that guy living here, but before we all made Aliyah, the little girl went, her father said, Aliyah, we're going to go swimming. And she said, okay, and she's swimming. And she's like, Abba, we forgot my swimsuit. And he said, oh, that's okay. And somehow I just love that story.
Yeah. So did she do a conversion, and when she hit the age of bat mitzvah, did they make her do that?
I don't think there was any, I don't remember any sort of ceremony like that. And
I think you only have to reject it. I don't think there's any that accepted it.
Again? Okay.
I think if you reject it, it's something different, but I don't think it's affirmation. That's required.
I was at the mikveh with a convert. Yeah, an older young woman, but there was a little girl also with a, she had a, one of the swimming rings around her, and I guess they must have explained to her, and she said she was going around singing her Yom Yom Hulada. She was born
again.
But she was happy, and she kept singing and singing.
Wow.
Allison,
yes.
After your conversion, you know, they said that we have to be extra compassionate to converts, to et cetera, et cetera. And did you feel immediately a part, or did you feel that it took you time, or?
It took me
and
time.
And how did the family?
It took me time. And it was, like, my family was okay with it. My dad was a little more, it was harder for him to accept that. What was interesting was I converted in Buffalo, and then Stevie and I got married a few months later, and I moved to Toronto. So it was going to Toronto. Toronto's a more conservative, even like the reforming conservative, more conservative than in America. So it's a more conservative city in general, and I felt a little out of breath, like I couldn't breathe there. Really, it was hard. It was a harder community, and I felt like eyes were, like people had to do what their neighbors thought they should do. And I was very concerned making Aliyah that I was coming to a very homogeneous environment, and I was so pleased to come to a country of Jews where no two are alike. I think that's part of, I think people in Chutz Laaretz, they don't understand it. They don't understand the freedom to be Jewish that's here, that does not exist there. I really don't think they get it. Because I don't think you can get it unless you're here. You know, there's a lot more. I mean, I'm not talking, the people in Mea Shearim, they have to be, they're in a...
Communities that build up the walls. And
yeah, they live in a walled community, literally, so, you know. But
it's different here,
yeah.
You're right. And this is so, because I'm new here, and I come from Baltimore, which love. It's a wonderful community, but it's more of everyone kind of fitting in. And I went to Beis Yaakov, and I went the whole route, and it's more of everyone fitting in, and if you do a little different, like, I'm the only one of my, there are two people in my Beis Yaakov graduating class that we don't cover our hair.
Yeah.
Two of us. So it's a little, it's so just different. Huh? Not being bride, I know, she's in another class, she was older. But there's,
I didn't go to,
but she and I are the only two. And it's very difficult when I'm with my old group, because, like, they're just freaked out by it. Some of them still. It's hard.
Yeah.
And they said things like, oh, your kids are not going to stay for long, because I sent them to, some of them went to Beis Yaakov, but others went to community day school. And all my kids, they thought of Shomer Shabbat, and they're happy, and they have children that are into Judaism. And some of the others that said stuff, that, you know, that wanted to fit, you can't fit. Everybody doesn't fit the same mold.
No.
Here, that's where I love Ashkelon. Like, I was nervous about moving in, and I came here and I met everyone, and they're just accepting.
Yeah.
And it's just wonderful. I'm pleased. Very
great.
Pleased.
Welcome.
How long have you been here? officially, we made Aliyah a year ago, but then I was in Hashmonaim with our kids because my apartment was rented out and I didn't want to kick the guy out till it was time for him to leave. So I think we came in like, no, we took the apartment back, I think September, October, but then I had to go to the States for Sukkot. So I actually came November 1. November 1 is when I actually started living here.
Like, in Ashburn.
But we bought the apartment.
But maybe as a convert, or because I was there in the mid 90s.
We're fine people, and the three of us are here.
Thank you very much. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.
Thank you.